This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, June 14th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her website is VeraIconaPublishers.org, and her YouTube channel is youtube.com/VeraIcona100, and there's a lot of really, really wonderful videos and audio files at YouTube that she has uploaded. So please go there and access those. She is the author of many, many books and the translator and editor of others, and it's just delightful that we're able to talk in this environment where there is no commercials to interrupt and distract. So welcome.
Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent.
And you are good?
I am doing very well. I had a little issue with I updated our website because it's WordPress, and apparently it had a little password issue. It's resolved.
Oh, good.
So everyone's reading password should be working now.
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes those updates cause funny problems.
Yeah. Yeah, I was having a little issue, and I thought, gosh, what am I doing wrong here?
So, okay, yeah, that's resolved.
And, great.
Yeah, I noticed you dropped in on the Hitler's Illuminati hands. It's ridiculous.
Oh, my gosh.
Hitler did not hold up his hands and make an Illuminati pyramid like the rappers today, people.
They just want to accuse him of everything and anything, or create something that doesn't exist. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
They just won't let the man rest.
Right. They won't let the man rest. So, yeah, it's crazy. All right. And on that topic, the Reichstag fire. That's another one that just doesn't seem to die, because we all think that Hitler orchestrated a false flag to give himself dictatorial powers, which he in fact never even had. Hitler's power was limited, and the NS state was never a monolithic state. So this is just contrary to fact. And the thing is the Enabling Act was not a result of the fire, but was going to happen anyway. Everybody knew that the Enabling Act was coming and that Hitler was going to dissolve the multi-party state. He was very proud of that achievement, and that was one of the first things he boasted about when, you know, he was finally ushered into power. And rightfully so, I might add, because his party had the majority in the Reichstag. So that's another thing that people tend to go, well, you know, that Reichstag fire, now Hitler barely made it in. True. He barely made it in because he was a true patriot, was going to actually do something about all the corruption, the multi-party nonsense in these hacks that weren't getting anything done, and they didn't want him in there, and they did everything in their power to keep him out. And so he, in turn, had to blackmail and, you know, unleash similar weapons that they were using against him. And that's what he did. And I do suspect that he blackmailed Hindenburg, because Hindenburg was in some kind of Junker estate tax thing that he, when he got this deed, he put it in his son's name so that his son would not have to pay the death taxes on it, because he was already 85. So the deed was in the son's name. Absolute corruption going on, even from Mr. Hindenburg, who's always portrayed as, you know, this kind of sainted general. No. No, so Hitler got wind of that and used it against Hindenburg, because Hindenburg had kept him out. So this is our lead in here for this Reichstag fire.
Alrighty.
And there's one other thing I just want to say really quick. This is all connected. Gleiwitz, the Jewish declaration of war against, quote, Hitler Germany, end quote, the Reichstag fire, and Kristallnacht. These are all part of what I have ultimately come to see as a continuum of provocations against Germany to absolutely demolish the state in the eyes of the rest of the world.
Well, that's
it was
interesting.
A long process.
Because, you know, we usually view these as individual incidences, but
I used to until
yes.
now. Yeah, this is a connection I've only made recently. I've reread Ingrid Veckert's book for the third time, and after writing The Union Jackal and then reading that again, I'm putting this all together, but here's what I've got. It was a long process from 1933 to 1939, which is Gleiwitz. So I'm thinking of an incident, Radio Warsaw, which Jabotinsky had announced over Radio Warsaw on April 28th, 1933, his declaration of war on behalf of World Jewry, or what I now call Jutsi Israel, on Hitler Germany. Well, it turns out that Mr. Jabotinsky was connected to Mr. Bernard Lacache, or Lacache, however you say that in France, Paris in particular, who was in charge of none other than the LICA, the LICA, which is basically France's ADL / SPLC.
Right.
It is now today known as the LICRA, but it still exists and it's still in Paris. Well, this cute little organization had its hand behind assassin David Frankfurter, Jewish, Marinus van der Lubbe, Dutch, suspected of being Jewish, but so far we have not been able to affirm that. It appears he was just a Dutch communist, and Herschel Greenspan, Jewish murderer.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Very interesting. And of course, as we know, conspiracy, quote unquote, is all about connections. Well, did these people orchestrate the Reichstag fire? Did they maybe inspire Torgler or one of these other communists to do that? After all, the communists were in the building just 20 minutes before the fire broke out. Now, the important thing is Hitler and Goering believed until the very end that the communists were involved. Now, if we're going to say, oh, Hitler lied and he deceived until the last of his days, why would he lie to Martin Bormann and other private officials like Himmler and whatnot during his Tischgespräche, his table talks in private, that he still swears it was Torgler, but he just couldn't prove it? Why lie? In the 1940s?
Right.
Who does he need to lie for or to?
Sure. And it was such a disadvantage to them. Why would they do
exactly.
Some? Yeah.
They lost the trial, and Goering turned out to be, like, you know, seen as this bumbling buffoon. Even Goebbels was, like, shaking his head going, oh, just be quiet. You blew it. You ruined everything for us. This Reichstag fire thing is horrible.
Right.
So let's ask ourselves. If the NSDAP and Hitler were so conniving and mendacious and all-powerful and so smart about planning these things, why did they bumble it? Why did they lose the trial? Okay, they were, you know, the world was outraged that they still put Marinus van der Lubbe to death. They probably shouldn't have done it. Honestly, I think that hurt the NSDAP. But at that point, the German leadership wanted to send a real clear message to any communists. It's not going to be tolerated. Forget it. You're not going to incite some little terroristic event to prevent us from holding the elections in March, which is going to solidify our power.
Given all of the experiences with the communists in the previous 10 years and following World War I and all the things the communists attempted to do in Germany, I can kind of understand why they would put him to death.
Exactly. And I go over that. I mean, we can't forget about Red Rosa, Eisner. You know, brown shirts died.
Yes.
In the hundreds, in the thousands, fighting these people in the streets. It's not like there wasn't a real threat there. And the Soviet Union is next door. And everybody knew about the terror coming from there. There were enough emigres getting out of there, especially white Russian emigres who had a hand in the creation of the NSDAP in its early years because they were connected through the Tula Society, that it was just unbelievable barbarism. Okay, now, not that white Russia, you know, the Tsar, weren't kind of ruthless in their own way, but it was completely surpassed by the Bolsheviks. Completely surpassed.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't think anyone can deny that. Even Jews ended up being persecuted by the hand that initially they had fed and held, which was Bolshevism. they played a very prominent, if not, you know, imperative role in creating it, in creating communism and Bolshevism in particular. And yet they suffered from it as much as everyone else. They were also sent to gulags. And Stalin ultimately wanted them either mass deported or slaughtered en masse, which, you know, started with that one show trial during the war. Stalin didn't care about Jews anymore. He had used them for what he needed, and now it was time for them to be purged. So I don't believe that Stalin had any particular inclination toward Jews. And if I'm not mistaken, I think his Jewish wife died or was killed, or I don't know what happened there, but...
Yeah, I know his first wife, who he really apparently loved, reportedly, passed away early, and then he married somebody else that was Jewish, the sister of one of his comrades.
Right. That he supposedly never loved.
Right. Right.
I think it's crazy.
Yes, I'm not sure he was capable of it because of his. Of his psyche. I mean, he was...
Exactly. Psychic. Yeah, so, I mean, we do need to keep this in mind.
Right.
As we're thinking about the Reichstag fire. Now, the thing is you know, Martin Sommerfeld was one of the witnesses who saw Goering, and he said, you know, he was calm, but definitely deeply affected by this fire. And the first thing Goering did was order that the tapestries in the library be saved.
Right.
And that was very important to him. Okay, this was a government building. It was a long-standing government building. It had special meaning to people who were very nationalist. You know, you don't go burning down our traditional German buildings, you creepy communists. Now, if he had planned it, if he... had been the incendiary, as, you know, Mauro Giafferi of the Leica screamed in the court to the world. You know, we call it the quote heard round the world that Goering was the incendiary. Why didn't he save those tapestries ahead of time?
Sure, sure, absolutely. And the very thought that Hitler would have anything to do with this, given his love for architecture and given his love for those kinds of cultural things,
right.
I just don't think that he would have done that.
It doesn't make sense.
No, it's totally incompatible with his mentality.
In fact, Hitler was careful not to destroy French architecture.
Yes.
He kind of scoffed at the Eiffel Tower? Well, this isn't quite as good as our architecture, but I'm not going to take it down.
Right.
Okay, Hitler wasn't like that. In fact, you know, the destruction of Warsaw did not come until the Warsaw Uprising, which we've gone over, wherein there were weapons caches under the street. This was a massive, you know, uprising on the part of the Home Army, you know, in an effort to kind of hook up with the communists and push the Germans back out during their war effort, kind of a war behind the lines. So that was something Hitler was even reluctant to do, was blow away an entire city.
Right.
It just doesn't fit. So, yeah, I'm not buying it either. And, you know, as for Goering, he wasn't worked up about this whole communist thing until Rudolf Diels, chief of the Gestapo at the time, suggested it. You know, he was the one that, you know, had overheard Marinus van der Lubbe talking about, yeah, there's going to be a strike and, you know, we're going to attack you fascists and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, Diels freaks out and gets Goering all in an uproar. And that's basically what happened. It was kind of like your mass psychology of frenzy taking off. And anyone can see this. I mean, look at any fire. The San Diego fires that raged not long ago, you know,
right,
a few years ago. People act insane during these kind of things. So, you know, that frenzy catches on. And that's kind of what was going on here. And another thing, buildings set afire, revolutionary acts like this, assassinations, these were very stunning to people and outrageous back then. Not like today, you know, where we champion somebody blowing up a government building kind of a thing. That did not happen back then. It was considered outrageous and angered people.
Right. And it was always the revolutionaries, the Bolsheviks and the Jews
Exactly.
that did this kind of terrorist activities. Germany never did those kinds of things. And if you look now, of all of the so-called false flags and terrorist activities, I mean, it's basically the same people.
Right. Yes. And the whole false flag idea comes from Britain. And the United States adopted this. What they would do is the Navy, you know, the Navy forces would change their flag at the last second. They'd come in as a neutral. Oh, we're flying a British flag. We're cool. You guys don't have to shoot us. This was particularly with regard to Tripoli, Thomas Jefferson. Come in with a British flag, peaceful, peaceful. And the last second, you'd pull down that British flag and put up the American flag and open fire on the Pasha's ships. And destroy him, obliterate him. That was the literal false flag. So that they were lulled into a sense of, oh, this is a British ship. They're here on friendly terms because they were peaceful with the Pasha. No, not the case. So this is kind of more or less a Jewish Anglo thing. And of course, we know the Lusitania, huge questions around the Athenia. Those were proven to be zero connection to the Germans. So
absolutely.
Germans
yes.
don't do false flags.
They don't.
It's just they don't. It doesn't exist in their political culture and their history. So we can get over that. I think the reason we're so, oh, false flag, false, is because we do that. This is a case of projection.
Yes.
So, you know, we're used to that. It's so typical in our history. Yeah. So, you know, Hitler and Goebbels get there at 10:20 p.m., and of course, Goering tells them, you know, he's in a frenzy at this point. It's the communists. It's finally happening. They're going to keep you from power. They're going to go after us. Okay, so they get Goebbels and Hitler all worked up. Hitler was a little reluctant at first. He's like, I hope to God this is the work of the communists because that would be really good for me. We have elections coming up. You know, good, good, good. I want to get as many voters on board with this NS takeover as possible. But eventually he was in a frenzy too.
Right.
That's not how Goebbels describes him. He always goes, oh, the Führer issued orders so calmly and matter of fact. No, he didn't. He was screaming for communists to be shot on the spot, for communist Reichstag members to be hanged, not thinking about the consequences of what he's saying. Okay, so the guy is clearly not totally there as far as calm and reserve.
Right.
He's reacting to the situation. So this is all part and parcel of genuine reaction.
Right.
And of course, our favorite, Sefton Delmer, was there, British spy. He said it wasn't faked. He didn't think so. And if anyone would have said it was, he would have been the one. Because then Britain would have had a field day in their press.
Right. Now, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, he used this to grab power, when in fact, he basically was already in office. There was no reason for doing this at all. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. He was already in power. Here's the thing, and this is what Hans Mommsen writes, and this is probably the most important piece of information here. Adolf Hitler announced while still at the scene of the fire that come what might, okay, maybe we're going to have an uprising after all, elections would take place on March 5th no matter what. Okay, his main concern was that the elections be held the coming March. Okay, we're talking about like January, February, but less than 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He thought that the communists, through this act and perhaps something more to follow, we're trying to prevent the elections to keep him from consolidating his power.
Right.
So he saw it as a conspiracy against him. And that's part of why he acted so quickly and feverishly. He's like, they are not going to cheat me of this now. I am in office. I've had to blackmail my way in. I've been fighting 14 years. I've got people that have died for me. Ain't going to happen. No way. Not when I'm this close.
Right.
Let's put ourselves in his shoes and think about that.
Yes.
All that suffering, all those years, and they're going to try to cheat me in less than 2 months with this nonsense. I don't think so. So, you know, the elections were supposed to be held there, I believe. And he said, if we need to, we're going to change the locality. They will be held. So that's very important, perhaps the most important piece of information that no one looks at.
It's because they don't want to.
Or they don't know about it. I mean, the problem is aspects of the Third Reich is out of print. It was published in, I believe, 1984, and it's obsolete. It's very difficult to get. Hopefully, it will go back into print. But, you know, I've got the whole entire thing in the Union Jackal. So now people don't have an excuse not to know the facts about the Reichstag fire.
Good.
It is in here. Every piece of key information is in here. I mean, I go above and beyond even Mommsen. I bring in information that's come to us since then. You know, and of course, we have more insight because we've had more declassification since the 80s. We've got a better idea of what was happening. So, you know, this is actually, I would say, an even slightly improved edition on that. So if somebody wants the real nitty-gritty details, time of day, who was there, what they said, that's Mommsen's account.
Okay.
So, but again, van der Lubbe's language at the hearing, you know, he was using words like signal, flare, and strike.
Hmm.
That wasn't too good to be telling to National Socialists who were on the verge of power and thinking they might be cheated here.
Yes.
So he kind of put his foot in his mouth. But I believe he was being honest. I believe that Marinus van der Lubbe thought that he alone could kind of inspire the communists to take action because they weren't doing enough. And as a matter of fact, the KPD, the Communist Party in Germany, had been kind of sitting back as a tactical ploy and keeping quiet. And so people like van der Lubbe were going, you know, you're selling us out. You creeps are selling us out. Forget the Communist Party. I'm going to act on my own. And he was no, you know, mentally deficient dolt. That is a lie. He was a very intelligent kind of loner type who was fed up with the nonsense and the leadership that wasn't getting anything done, in his opinion. So he took it upon himself to do something about it.
Hmm. And of course, they always portray him as some kind of mentally defective person.
They have to have that, though, because if you don't have that, then he can't be the patsy, and he couldn't have been the one who acted on his own initiative.
Of course.
The thing is, Carlos Porter looked into all this. He looked deeply into Marinus van der Lubbe. It's on his site, Carlos Whitlock Porter. I think it's cwporter.com.
Okay.
He's got that down. So Porter's the one, you know, it's in the Fritz Tobias book too, The Reichstag Fire. But Porter went above and beyond in blowing that myth straight out of the water. So there is no one else. The communists don't seem to have been implicated, even though Hitler still believed it in the 40s. And the NSDAP, there's absolutely zero evidence that they were connected. The only answer is van der Lubbe on his own initiative. And it does happen. It does occasionally happen.
Sure.
Where you have a patriotic person who just is inspired and does it. They have nothing left to lose. Boom. And those are actually the most dangerous. They don't need any direction.
Yes.
So he's one of those. And, you know, he was put to death. And I think that was probably not tactically good for the NSDAP, but it's really beside the point. He had committed a crime that was worthy of that sentence. So, but basically, you know, the police report fell on the overheated imaginations of the Germans present, of the NSDAP members present, including Hitler. So, you know, as soon as they heard his, oh, he's using strike, signal, flare, this is it. The KPD is not going to let us take power without a struggle. That's just not possible. They couldn't believe that the KPD was just going to sit by and let power slip out of their hands. Couldn't believe it. So that was another thing.
It's a very interesting event. And
right. And also the thing is they were fearing kind of a civil war situation breaking out.
Of course, because that had happened so often in other countries
exactly.
Earlier.
Was this the beginning, like the assassination of French Duke Ferdinand kind of a thing? You know
right.
What I mean? Or Archduke Ferdinand. That's kind of what they were thinking. And then, of course, at 11:15 p.m. that night, an emergency conference was held at the Prussian Ministry of the Interior. Everyone says this was a cabinet meeting. It was not. It was just an impromptu meeting of officials who happened to be there. It was not a cabinet meeting that night. So,
well, I mean, you would expect that people would meet to figure out what was going on.
Right. And I mean, the opposition says, oh, it was a cabinet meeting because, you know, the Enabling Act, the emergency decree, the concentration camps. No.
How stupid.
The concentration camps were not a result of the fire. They were already in the making and they were prepared for a potential civil war situation. And as a matter of fact, fervent brown shirt types and other National Socialists were interned in them as well to keep them from stirring the communists into a civil war situation. So, whoops, we put our own people in there and it's supposed to be an anti-German civilian kind of thing where the NSDAP is going after everybody and their brother and sister and threatening to throw them in these camps. Not at all. In fact, they were almost entirely inhabited by KPD members after the fact. And this was well after the fact.
Right.
And Hitler made no, he didn't hide that. The communists knew what was coming. We need to be real clear about that.
Sure. Absolutely.
So most of them got away, in fact, because at the time, Goering did not have complete police powers, and neither did Hitler. Okay, so the police was not yet subordinated to the NSDAP. The state police was not subordinated to the national police. And so a lot of these functionaries of the KPD got away. Whoops, we really bungled that false flag, didn't we, Hitler?
Oh, you know? Yes. I mean,
wouldn't
because...
Wouldn't have been that stupid.
Yes, exactly. Because they could have used this event, if it were truly a false flag that they had arranged, they could have used that event to incarcerate a whole lot of people to really stop the communists from their further activity within the Reich.
Right. Mm-hmm. And people need to understand, you got elections coming up in March. Hitler's still just mostly a plurality, you know, Reichstag majority, but vote-wise plurality.
Mm-hmm.
You really think he's going to start throwing German civilians, potential voters, into concentration camps?
Not likely.
Before they've solidified the power?
Amazing.
It's senseless. I mean, for some reason, we have this idea in our head that Hitler was this wild man, loose cannon that just isn't there. It isn't there. That is pure propaganda. Pure propaganda.
But look how much propaganda, look how many decades of that people have built up this image of him. And uh-huh. And of course, they always show him when he's giving a speech, when he's very, very passionate.
Right.
And they imply that he's some sort of monster, that he's some sort of crazy person that's yelling and screaming all the time.
Right.
It just isn't the case.
Exactly. And I mean, that's how oratory was back then. Now, Mussolini didn't get quite as passionate. He had a different style. But come on, nobody would talk like those two today. Everyone would look at him like, whoa, that's scary. You know what I mean? So we kind of need to think about oratory back then, totally different. Now the president just kind of stands there and looks back and forth between two teleprompters.
Right.
And if there's something misspelled, he reads it just as it is. So,
at least Hitler was creative. He didn't need a teleprompter, didn't need notes. I mean, he just got up and spoke from his heart.
Right. And he was literate. Thank goodness. Yeah, exactly. Hitler hardly ever even used notes, and sometimes it was 100% impromptu.
Right.
When he gives that one speech to the youth in the Triumph of the Will, that's completely impromptu, and he's good. So nobody can doubt that. But anyway, this wasn't a cabinet meeting, as we're always told, where, you know, oh, Enabling Act and martial law. In fact, Hitler opposed martial law. He said absolutely not, because he saw that as a threat to the elections. He didn't want the army involved at all. And he made that real clear to Werner von Blomberg. So another thing about this is that arrests and security measures were the main topics discussed. Hitler does not mention at any point a Reichstag-fired decree. So that
Veronica,
was not the center of the discussion.
Veronica, your audio seems to be kind of cutting out a bit.
Is it?
I don't know whether you're positioned in a different way from your mic or...
No, it's a headset.
Okay, yeah.
Is it okay now?
No, it seems... Maybe it's on my end, but... Just all of a sudden, it just seemed kind of fuzzy.
That's really weird. Okay, headset, everything's plugged in okay, and my internet connection is
Yeah,
okay.
mine is too. Okay, let's just go ahead and.
Okay, hopefully it'll
Oh,
be
now it's great. Now it's perfect.
okay. Must have been it could have been a connection glitch. Okay,
Okay.
so what did you where did I leave off as far as what you heard?
You didn't miss anything. I didn't miss anything. It was just just like you
Scratchy.
were scratchy, like you were speaking through some water or something. But
Okay.
I
We'll
heard
back it
everything
off.
you said.
Let me back it off a little bit. This is one of those Dragon headsets that comes with the software, and it's not that great.
Okay.
Okay, so basically the decree that everyone's told, oh, it was all about that fire decree. No, that was not at the center of the discussion at all. And as a matter of fact, Hitler did not even propose the decree. It was, I believe it was Frick, but let me find that one part. I don't know if I can find that right. I'm pretty sure it was Frick who was the one who actually proposed it. And then later on, Hitler agreed. I can't actually find that direct reference yet. Let me just keep going from there then. Okay, so I'm pretty sure it was Frick, but I'll find it eventually. So another thing. Shortly after this meeting, which was impromptu, it wasn't planned, Hitler and Goebbels rush over to the Völkischer Beobachter office. This is their party paper. They stop the printing press, halt everything. They had a new front page written then and there. Hitler dictated it. Was it planned? Absolutely not, because the South German edition had already gone out without a word about the Reichstag fire, not even so much as a mention of it, let alone on the front page. So it wasn't planned. If they had planned this and it was their thing, it would have been at the ready.
Yes.
Yes. They certainly would have at least had a story ready to go and said, okay, send the story out now.
Right.
Didn't happen. They had to physically drive there. So, and this is all happening at past 11:15 at night. Who would, people wouldn't go out of their way to, oh, let's make sure it's real late at night so it looks, more suspicious to the people. No, they would have had it ready, sitting at the press. Okay, at exactly this time, go ahead and put that as the front page kind of a thing.
Right.
So,
I mean, that's the way the Americans have always done it, right?
Exactly, exactly. And apparently the Völkischer Beobachter had overstated things a bit, because what they said is that Ernst Torgler, a KPD leader, had voluntarily gone into custody, but he didn't voluntarily go into custody. So this was a mistake that the overzealous Hitler and Goebbels had to retract in the Völkischer Beobachter. Oh, yeah, that was a mistake. Let's just brush that under the carpet. And, of course, Goering is like calling the Sommerfeld communique garbage. He uses the C word, but we won't say that. But he's like, this is like a police report from Alexanderplatz. Because he's getting ready. He's like, no, you don't tell me that you can't find anything. You don't tell me this isn't actually the strike, okay? I'm ready to deal these communists their final blow, so don't tell me this is nothing. And Sommerfeld's going, but it isn't anything. So basically, after the fact, after everyone had sort of calmed down, they realized that, whoops, we overreacted. And this didn't really become clear to them until a couple days later. They're like, okay, everything's quiet. What's going on? Where's the uprising? Didn't happen. KPD was sitting back. And the thing is the couple weeks span between this event that was allegedly the work of the KPD and the elections actually gave the KPD better PR and a chance to recover from the media. So it actually benefited the KPD more.
Okay, so you have to ask the question with any event, who benefits?
Exactly. And the NSDAP was, in fact, accused by many a German and the Jewish press at the time, and certainly the communist press as well, that, we think that the NSDAP did this on purpose. Yeah, they were behind the fire. Uh-huh. Trying to hurt their election chances. So this whole thing that the German, that, Hitler and the NSDAP was behind it, that was floated at the time. It's nothing new.
Right.
But, you know, basically all the NSDAP was doing was they really believed this was an uprising. And because the fire was such a serious affront to the nation and to nationalists, they simply wanted to exploit it and capitalize on it to maximum effect for the coming elections, because then it would make them look like they were serious about terror, serious about communism, and voters should vote for us because, you know, we're that efficient and ruthless with these terrorists. Okay, so they weren't, in fact. They kind of bungled the whole thing. They weren't so ruthless and stuff. So this is, you know, PR that the NSDAP pushed about itself that historians and other people have picked up on as actual.
Right.
It's but truthful, if, but it isn't.
But of course, they had such a wonderful party platform, and they had so many other things going for them that they they certainly didn't need some big false flag in order to gain votes.
Right. They didn't need a false flag, but what Hitler's aim was, I want to get those fence sitters, as many as possible, because so many voters, and this is just, this is beyond any doubt, every politician knows this, totally fair weather, don't know what they want, and they literally vote by how they feel day by day,
mm-hmm.
by an event. Oh, there was a recent terror attack, 9/11, I'm going to vote for Bush.
Right.
This inevitably happens, and Hitler knew that. He wasn't stupid. So he was going to use that to his advantage. So, you know, only a fool wouldn't. Now, as we know, Hitler got rid of democracy voting because it's a joke.
Right.
At least in that respect, he saw that it was kind of this joke and went, that system's going to go bye-bye because it's foreign to Germany anyway. They were always an authoritarian republic, and liberal democracy was forced on them by the Allies. So it's not in their tradition, unlike the Anglo-Saxon nations, which have had a longer tradition with that form of government. We would freak out at an authoritarian government. But Germans, not so much. Even their government today, it's still an authoritarian republic. I don't care what anyone says. It is not a democracy there. Show me the freedom in West Germany.
Right. Well, of course, when this country was set up, it wasn't a two-party system.
Exactly.
I mean, so.
Right. We became a liberal democracy, but, you know, we've always kind of had the voting thing
mm-hmm.
where propertied male, white males could vote, and then it extended, and then it extended some more because of Masonry and other liberal forces.
Right.
But, yeah, that's a good point. We were not initially a democracy, let alone a two-party democracy state and a liberal democracy. That we were not, absolutely not. So, you know, that's something we should probably think about as well.
Right. But it's so amazing because look at what happened after 9/11. I mean, the Patriot Act was written probably 3 to 4 years before that and was all ready to go into it to be imposed upon the population. And then we have this false flag and there it is. And
right. Exactly. They had it at the ready. Hitler did not have his enabling act at the ready. It came well after the fact, and he wasn't even the one that proposed it.
Exactly.
So here it is, Frick. Okay, so Frick's decree, which was voted on the morning of February 7th. Okay, this was originally proposed. It was drafted and proposed by Ludwig Grauert, head of the Berlin Police Department. Revised by Frick. Hitler had nothing to do with it. So Grauert's decree was written up impromptu, and it was voted on by the entire cabinet on the morning of February 27th. So that would be the cabinet meeting.
Right.
Okay, and then it was sent to Hindenburg. He signed it the next day. So the Reichstag fire decree, as it has come to be called, it wasn't called that, arose spontaneously after the fire, and Frick decided to use the Prussian decree of July 20th that was already in existence as the basis for this post-fire decree. The only two different provisions from the previous Prussian one was number one, the suspension of constitutional rights, and number two, infringement on state sovereignty. Now, why would they suspend constitutional rights? This has nothing to do with going after individuals. This had to do with nationalizing, centralizing, subordinating the states to the federal government, This was literally the process that the United States went through when Virginia and Rhode Island and all of our little nation states became subordinate, simple states, lender to our federal government, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Germany was not yet a united, subordinated country. They weren't, you know, the states were not subordinated to the federal government. That is the number one thing Hitler had on his mind. I want a one nation system. There mm-hmm. is no Bavaria, Saxony, Germany. You know what I mean? These aren't their own entities. They're all part of Germany.
Right.
So that was really the basis of the decree. It had nothing to do with going after, you know, Klaus and Ava, you know, your average Klaus and Ava's running around the street. So, and the thing is numerous presidents before Hitler and chancellors had ruled by decree as well. And they suspended constitutional rights periodically, certainly infringed them. Now, if we're going to go, oh, well, you know, the Communist Party and the SPD, they were, you know, banished under this. It ruined their, they did not have constitutional rights. The Weimar Constitution did not guarantee the rights of a party, only individuals. So it was perfectly legal. Hitler could disband any party he wanted.
Right.
Perfectly constitutionally. So that's pretty much all that can be said on that. And I mean, the decree cannot be regarded, in Hans Mommsen's words, as an organic preliminary phase of the Enabling Act. You know, the only thing was the abrogation of constitutional rights as opposed to curtailment, which was already in existence well before Hitler came in. And the fact is, this post-fire decree of Fricks did not change much. The press really wasn't suppressed. It wasn't used. It, you know, its qualities led to quantitative, not qualitative, changes in the general situation. And sweeping government powers, you know, were already enforced before the decree. So this didn't actually really affect many people. And Goering seldom even used it. So if you're going to have a false flag and the intent is to get this fire decree, why not use it?
Sure.
Okay. So that blasts it out the water right there, I think.
Yes.
And that's pretty much it.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, Hitler did not actually use the fire decree to integrate the states. That only happened after the elections in March.
Okay.
So, you know, the idea was there that we're going to unify and nationalize this country. But not even the fire decree that everyone makes such a big deal about was used for that. So there you go. Now, as far as the enabling bill, it was not illegal. Hitler did not dissolve the Reichstag at any point. It periodically met as it was supposed to. The Weimar Constitution did not protect political parties from dissolution, so their eradication was constitutional. The rights of the Reich president, Hindenburg, were never impaired by Hitler. And finally, everyone agreed that the Enabling Act would end only, quote, when the present government was replaced by another, end quote. That only happened in 1945 with the Allied quote-unquote victory.
Right.
So Hitler did not infringe on any aspect of the Weimar Constitution with the Enabling Act.
Hmm.
Perfectly legal.
Yes.
So that's pretty much it.
And the thing about his government, his reign, his mm-hmm. what he did, was so beneficial for the people. And when you compare it to, for instance, our country, mm-hmm. There is such a huge difference. I mean, his government allowed people to benefit. Everybody was equal, basically. Everybody had opportunities that they never had before. They had opportunities to go to work, to earn a living, to take care of their family, to even buy a car. I mean, he was not a tyrant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you ever see a book with Hitler and Stalin on the front, don't even buy it. Forget it. No one's allowed to make that comparison because it's outrageous. Hitler
sure.
and Napoleon? Yeah. Hitler and Mussolini? Yeah. Hitler and Franco? Sure. Hitler and Stalin, unacceptable. They know it. You know, that's
right.
Outrageous.
Now, wasn't there an author that did a book about how they were where he compared those two?
Yes. I made a point not to buy that. That's blacklist.
Yeah,
I don't. That's on my blacklist. So, yeah. And then real quick, more than 82% of the politicians in the Reichstag gave Hitler, quote unquote, dictatorial powers, which we've gone over. They really weren't. Okay. The SPD, who always screams persecution, together with all the other parties, unanimously endorsed Hitler's foreign policy resolution the following May 17th, 1933. And, of course, an enabling act was used to dissolve the multi-party state. So it wasn't, you know, there were no backdoor tricks or intrigues. That's all nonsense. And, of course, Hitler fused the offices of president and chancellor on the basis of another unanimous cabinet decision of August 1st, 1934, which was further sanctioned by a public plebiscite. Imagine that. He let the people confirm it.
Right.
I mean, we don't even have that. If Obama had a public plebiscite right now, I think he'd fail.
Of course.
It would be awful for him, and he probably knows that.
Of course.
Yeah. So where's the tyranny? You know, I don't see it.
Nor do I.
Yeah. So, you know, we can kind of go over some of these other connections. Thinking about the Reichstag fire now, which happened in 1933, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
On March 24th, 1933, we know that World Jewry declared war on Germany. And this happened almost immediately after Hitler was elected chancellor. So they're screaming about, oh, the persecution, extermination, blood's flowing in the street, before Hitler's even in power.
And he never mentioned Jews in the first 6 months.
Right. So we have this idiocy that prevails. And of course, lest we overlook it, Zindel Greenspan, little Herschel's father, was living on welfare payments even after 1933. Gee, isn't that interesting?
Yes.
That this Jewish mender, or whatever he was, clothes mender, was receiving welfare stipends from the NS state. Oh, the horror. You know, and it continues. It's insane. You know, and of course, in this declaration, the Jews say, quote, Germany may be called on to pay a heavy price for Hitler's antagonism to the Jews, end quote. This is in March, you know, March 24th, 1933. They're saying this in March and August because apparently it wasn't enough to declare war on Hitler just once. They had to do it again in July and August 1933, just to reiterate the point. And again, they confirmed it in 1938. I believe it was Weizmann who wrote to, was it Churchill or Chamberlain, where he said, oh, we're on board with you. The Jewish agency has declared war on, you know, Germany. It's like, how many times do you have to say this?
Right.
You know, and that's our Vladimir Jabotinsky. So, you know, who has connections with Leica, who has a base of operations in Warsaw, where the Gliwice incident supposedly, you know, I'm starting to see connections there.
Sure.
Isn't it interesting that certain places had these things happen? And of course, the David Frankfurter murder of Wilhelm Gustloff occurred in neutral Switzerland. How convenient.
Yes.
In a district that had no death penalty.
How handy.
And the boy Frankfurter moved to this part of Switzerland and then committed the murder. So did he know that? Seems like it.
Oh, I would say so, yes.
And then all of a sudden, Mauro Giafferi of the Leica shows up from Paris to assume his defense. Interesting.
Well, that's how they always handle everything.
Exactly.
They cover each other's murders. They cover each other's crimes. And when we talk about international Jewry declaring war on Germany, we do have to understand that they did work as a unit, that they were unified more than any other ethnic or ideological group ever in the history of the world. And so when And that is true. I mean, name another group that is so unified and that when they do something, they do it, they all support it.
Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, even Jewish sociologists, doctorate sociologists affirm this. That's in Ingrid Veckert's book, Flashpoint. If anyone's interested in reading that, she includes quite a bit about what Jews themselves say about this, and they confirm it.
Right.
Yeah, they don't hide it. And I mean, we all just, all we hear about is the April 1st, 1933 boycott that the Germans enacted against the Jews in retaliation for this worldwide frenzy boycott, which even involved the Jewish War Veterans Association of the United States of America.
Exactly.
Was a half-day boycott on the Sabbath. So, you know, most observant Jews didn't even work that day anyway. The shops weren't even open.
Right.
Most of them. It's just, yeah, it's kind of madness. For some reason, Jabotinsky hated Germany. Why? No one knows. So he announces his anti-Hitler crusade in grand style, of course, on April 28th, 1933, with his speech over Radio Warsaw, and that's when he declares the worldwide boycott. Well, we know the Reichstag fire occurred on the night of February 27th, 1933. Gee, that's not that far away from that time. This is just 1 month before the Jewish War Declaration, and 1 month before the half-day anti-Jutsi boycott, I call it. So, you know, all of a sudden we have Mauro Giafferi appearing as though he's some apparition from heaven. Goering, thou art the incendiary at the trial. Then we have, in 1936, David Frankfurter go murder Wilhelm Gustloff, an NSDAP official in Switzerland. And lo and behold, there's Mauro Giafferi again, screaming to be the attorney for this young Jewish boy. Are we starting to kind of wonder whether or not there was a concerted effort to get a reaction from the Hitler government and a nasty one against the Jews so that they could be seen as victims of absolute horror, terror, and brutality so that we would all of a sudden be so sympathetic for their Palestinian cause?
Of course.
The only people who stood to gain from this were the Zionists who wanted Palestine in particular.
Right.
And that is what Jabotinsky wanted, and that's what Lukács supported. That is what Weizmann screeched for. There was nothing else. This is why these Jewish leaders did everything in their power to stop the Schacht plan, to intimidate Ruble, the George Ruble, who was working out the Ruble-Volstadt agreement. There were so many emigration proposals on Hitler's side that he said, I want the Jews to be able to emigrate with almost everything they own. I don't want to withhold their wealth. Anything you can do to get them out of here. And it was after the Kristallnacht because he had had it up to here. And I suspect that he saw that there was this strangulation and agitation going on and was finally fed up. He had finally buckled and said, fine, Palestine, get out. So that's what happened. But these leaders were so adamantly opposed to any other location but Palestine, they trashed any other plan. Had to be Palestine.
Right.
So.
Now, didn't Samuel Untermeyer have something to do with this also?
Oh, yeah. It was Untermeyer, Jabotinsky, Weizmann, Lukács. There were probably some others.
And
I'm sure Moenthal, Bernard Baruch, there were probably some others in there that played a little bit of a role.
They also had investments already in Palestine for the minerals that they had discovered there in 1906, 1907. And so it was an economic situation also because they were looking at at all the minerals in the Dead Sea, which were worth, trillions of dollars.
Exactly. So, yeah, we need to definitely start looking at this from the Jewish proclamation of war against Hitler Germany, they call it, Hitler Germany, all the way to the Gleiwitz incident, who, you know, the entire Gleiwitz case, we'll talk about this in future in more detail. That
right.
whole entire incident rests on one man.
Yes.
One man who was nobody, and he just so happened to be involved in the Venlo Affair, which compromised Britain. So Schellenberg is dead. Can't talk to him. He was also involved in the Venlo Affair, and he worked with Naujox. Everyone else is dead. Himmler, Heydrich, and Gestapo Müller, who disappeared and no one ever found the body of. Those three were supposedly the masterminds of the Gleiwitz, all dead. Gee, no one's still alive that we could get to, even after the war. And even Naujox, who was about to be brought to trial in post-war Germany for his alleged role in the murder of the Hanzik man who was found at that radio station.
Right.
Okay, the Germans suddenly make a movie out of it. The German authorities go, what? He murdered someone. He needs to be tried because of this movie in like 1979. No one had even heard about Gleiwitz until then, right? Okay.
Right.
So this movie comes out. They're inspired to try the man. Dies.
Hmm.
Very strange. Now, there's one man who talked to Naujox. And Naujox pretty much told him, what do you think happened? Because he asked him, did you plea bargain for your life? Did you sign those affidavits for your life? And he said, what do you think?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Yeah. What did Naujox have to lose? He was kind of a nobody, minor player. Yeah, I know about everything about Gleiwitz. I had all the details. I can recount it verbatim. I know exactly what time the car came, what it looked like, who was in it. I know that, you know, Heydrich stepped off the plane and went, hey, guys, Führer needs a casus belli for the war. I mean, just these idiotic details. Naujox remembered it all. Verbatim.
Yes.
The whole entire IMT case, the whole set
right.
of trials, all affidavit, confessions, Pohl, P-O-H-L, was tortured and beaten into... incriminating Walter Funk. That's why Walter Funk was hanged, because he was incriminated by a man who was tortured. So knowing that this happened, we cannot trust the IMT information.
Oh,
and Ingrid Beckert, yeah, Ingrid Beckert goes through several fraudulent telexes in Flashpoint, and you know we'll talk in detail in Kristallnacht in a future show because it's so important. Her book is so important. It really does need to be republished. IHR, hint, hint, hint.
Yeah.
Needs to be republished and updated.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah, and updated. But it's all in there. She went through those German documents verbatim and said, these are syntactically, grammatically gibberish.
Right.
They were written by Americans who did not have a command of German, and it's embarrassing.
Right.
Yeah, so.
I was lucky enough to have this book.
Yes, one can still get it used. There's the least expensive copy is $23, I think, right now on Amazon. I heard that Castle Hill Publishers is going to put out its own English edition, but I don't have confirmation on that. They do have it in German. It's called Feuerzeichen.
Okay.
So the German one is available. I don't think it's available online in English, though. At least not from Castle Hill. But hopefully they'll get that back in print.
Would be wonderful. Now, Castle Hill is associated with Germar Rudolph.
Correct.
Right. Yes.
And that's what I think he has another edition because that, you know, it was written by her. The IHR translation is obviously copyright IHR, but not the other one.
Right. Oh.
So hopefully that'll happen. But yeah, I plan on putting... I went through the entire book and have every detail down, every section that's really important. So, you know, I'll get that into a future book on Kristallnacht, her two accounts of Dachau and Gleiwitz all in one book. It's all going to go into one book.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
It'll be three birds with one stone.
That would be wonderful.
Right. It's not going to be her verbatim book, obviously, but it'll have all the pertinent details in there.
Right. That's all you really need.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is all part of a continuum. And so everyone, all listeners, the Reichstag Fire, part of a continuum to bash and trash NS Germany in the world's eyes and to get some kind of reaction out of the NSDAP or Hitler against the Jews for the cause of Palestine for Jewry. As Jutzi Israel. They always say Nazi Germany, so it's Jutzi Israel.
I love those new terms you've come up with. Yeah, that's wonderful.
We got Ritzy England, Soviet Russia, Yankee America, and Jutzi Israel. You got to start using these terms. If they're going to insist on Nazi Germany, then we'll start using similar terms in turn.
Right. Now, Germany did not come up with Nazi. That is a Western term.
Right.
And, people want to try to associate it with the Ashkenazi Jews, and that isn't valid.
And it's not national Zionism either.
No.
Eustace Mullins was wrong. He has a lot of things wrong about Hitler. I've torn apart his entire chapter on Hitler in a nice way, because Mullins did write some very good stuff.
He did.
But he's wrong about Hitler. He bought into that nonsense about Hitler like a lot of, revisionists and post-war historians and thinkers do and did and still do. For some reason, we're questioning everything except Hitler.
Right.
That needs to stop, because there was one person in this world who really did stand for something that meant anything.
Right.
So we have to keep that in mind.
And it's unfortunate, because a lot of people just trust Mullins for every word that he printed or said. And I think a lot of the disinformation may have come from him.
Yeah. He's one man. We must remember he's one man. He doesn't know everything. He didn't have a command of German. He has not gone into the German archival material or the IMT files like Ingrid Veckert, Mark Weber, a lot of these other people have and have done very, very good work in the past.
Right.
Ingrid Veckert is retired. She's done with it, but there are other people who could still be continuing their work.
Right.
And publishing these things. So hopefully they will think twice and start doing that.
Yes. Following your good example.
Yeah. I try, but it's so much. It's just there's so much going on. It's like we need more help. And honestly, we need more German translators. We need more help if people really want this information out there.
Okay.
It's just too much for one or two people.
Oh, absolutely. So yeah. People who can speak German, can translate German, email me.
Or even can play a role in publishing, typesetting even, if one can just send them a document, because that takes a tremendous amount of time. Even doing a book cover.
Right.
These are hours and hours. It takes about 6 hours to set up a good book cover. So, yeah. These are all things that would help tremendously.
Sure.
And that's pretty much all I have.
Well, that's quite a lot, actually.
Indeed it is. I've got like a 34-page plus storybook on Kristallnacht. So, that's probably going to be a couple shows worth.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. We'll set it up and we'll get that taken care of.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much and have a wonderful evening. And we will talk very, very soon.
All right. Thank you so much. And you too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.